and welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast.
Welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast with your host, Amrit Sander. So for anybody who's ever attended any of our leadership development programs, you'll have often heard me talk about oxytocin, the neuroscience of trust, and the amazing work by Paul Zak, who, in my humble opinion, I think he's one of the world's most famous neuroscientists. And that's the topic of this week's conversation is trust. Trust in the workplace and the impact on empathy and leadership development and everything else that we talk about, creating great experiences at work. And who better, and I am super, super excited, who better than to have as a guest than the man himself who pioneered research into this whole area of oxytocin, Paul Zak. So Paul Zak is our guest today. So Paul, thank you very much for joining me and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Amrit.
So Paul, before we dive into the detail, and I am fascinated with your research, I would love to know more about you, your background, your experience. Just tell us more about Paul Zak. Who is Paul Zak?
Oh, no one wants to hear that. I'm a professor at Claremont Graduate University and started four companies based on research I've done in my lab. And I'm really passionate about understanding humans. So I think you've seen humans. They're a really interesting species. I don't think I fully understand them. So I run experiments to try to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. And that's the hook for neuroscience, is that if I ask you or someone, you know, I see why they're doing what they're doing, they'll tell me something. And usually it has nothing to do with the real motivation. So if we want to understand the variety of human experiences, for me, that's a neuroscience problem. I really want to understand what's going on in the brain that makes you prefer vanilla ice cream and meat chocolate or much more interesting things. We've been doing a lot of work on communication and how humans figure out how to cooperate and with whom to cooperate and how they do that and how we communicate that cooperation, which I think is one of the hallmarks of human beings that differentiates us from lots of other species.
So, I mean, and this is a fascinating area. I have a real passion for neuroscience and psychology from an amateur perspective. But certainly combining it with the leadership work we do with employee engagement, there's an awful lot you see that fascinates you about why people do what they do, what's driving that. So I came across your famous article on the neuroscience of trust, and I thought it was fascinating. And it just made me wonder, how does somebody go about exploring something like oxytocin? And, you know, how did you come about that research? What was it that made you or led you to explore oxytocin as a chemical and what it does to you, to us in our bodies?
I mean, the sort of two answers are frustration and stupidity, like most interesting things in the world. I really was trying to understand, but even be able to predict, you know, why people would cooperate, and had done some work at the cross-country level showing that trust was among the strongest predictors economists have ever found to understand why some countries grow in their living standards and why others seem to stagnate or decline. And so this interpersonal trust measure was very interesting and actually had a fairly big impact. The World Bank flies me out and, you know, how do we raise trust in these countries? And inevitably, Amrit, I would get this question, which is, well, gosh, why don't two strangers ever trust each other? I said, well, you know, my work was really about environments and you know, legal systems. And then I thought, gosh, how can I be some trust expert, I put air quotes up, without actually understanding why two people who meet for the first time decide to shake hands and do a business deal? Or why, gosh, I have teenage daughters. Why, you know, you can go on a date with a guy you never met before and get in his car and feel comfortable. Like, that's really interesting. And the only reason we can live in big cities, London, LA, New York, is if we have something in our heads that says, you know, Amrit's safe and, you know, the guy across the street, not safe. How do we do that? So I kind of became obsessed with this. And in essence, I'm a tool guy. So I sort of my secret of my limited success has been to create tools to try to address hopefully interesting questions. And as I sort of happened across the animal research on oxytocin, they really hadn't been studied in humans other than sort of birth and breastfeeding. And those were not that interesting to me. So I really wanted to see if the mechanisms that that were enabled by oxytocin in animals, familiarity with conspecifics, reduction in stress, if those actually worked in humans. So in animals, they drill a hole in the skull and they sample spinal fluid. I thought, I don't know a lot about the humans, but I'm just guessing that's not the right tool. So the short answer is that we had to develop a tool to measure the human brain's acute production of oxytocin that, you know, many people use now, and developed another way to take synthetic oxytocin and shoot it into human brains through the nose safely. And so once you have tools, you can ask a lot of questions. And so, again, came back to that fundamental question, which is, how do we take, from the business setting, how do we take 100 people that kind of barely know each other or don't know each other, put them in a building and ask them to work together on a project or a couple of projects? Chimpanzees don't do that. You know, monkeys don't do that. Bees and ants do, but they're all genetically related. So this is, you know, it's not 100 people that you are, you know, who are your cousins and siblings. It's 100 weirdos that you never met before. How do we do that, right? So part of it is certainly pay, part of it is leadership, but part of it is this, what looks like from this 20 years of research is our innate desire to be part of a group of individuals working with a common purpose. And that seems like so much fluff until you actually say, oh, we actually have identified the neurologic mechanisms that identify that we not only are kind of biased towards cooperation, we have mechanisms of the brain that make it enjoyable, pleasurable for us to work in groups. So now if I, we're talking to some, crazy Marxist dude, exploitation of labor. No, actually, what the data look like from the neuroscience perspective is that people want to work in groups. We got to pay people. But we know, you know, for sure, that pay is a very weak motivator for people putting in high discretionary effort, for really working hard. No pay may get you no work, but a little bit of pay is enough to say, hey, we value you. But now I need to put you in, you know, in a situation where you can really excel. So now I get the value of being part of that group, about doing something even bigger than myself. So I think, you know, every organization at its core is about service, right? The reason I'm going to pay for this service, or the reason I have government agencies, is because they make my life better somehow. And so once, as an employee, I understand that my job ultimately is to serve others, we've shown in experiments that this greater purpose, I call transcendent purpose, is highly motivating for humans if they know that it helps others, and in particular, if they trust the people that they're working with.
So that's a really nice way of succinctly summarizing, I guess, what I've seen in our work. You know, people want leaders who are inclusive, who collaborate, who are fighting for a greater cause than just to make money. I mean, we all need to survive, but actually this is about how can we impact the world in a much better way. And just so I can clarify, is it that our need for collaboration is what drives oxytocin that creates trust, or is it the fact that we are looking for, you mentioned at the beginning of an example of threats, you know, and somebody who makes me feel secure. Is it the security that drives oxytocin, or is it the need for social bonding and collaboration that drives it? What is it that you found specifically?
I'm going to recast the question just a little bit. So we found, again, over 20 years, and people just Google me, lots of publications and scientific journals, that almost any positive social interaction I have will cause my brain to make oxytocin. When that happens, I get a reduction in physiologic stress. I get an increase in empathy. I'm better able to read your emotions. And I get this little kind of pleasure hit. The brain says, hey, keep doing that. That's probably valuable to you. So think of trust as kind of running on a continuum. It's not a zero-one variable, right? I'm giving you degrees of trust. So oxytocin is the same way. It has degrees. And so the more oxytocin release, the more connected I feel to you, the more effective I am as a cooperation partner, colleague, or for that matter, romantic partner, parent. The more connected I am, the more I get this oxytocin response, the more I want to get more of it. So I think for listeners, one of the most interesting things is not that we are stuck where we are. The brain is adapting at millisecond frequency, and there's very good evidence in animals and some evidence now in humans that the more I release oxytocin, the more I'm biased towards releasing it. In other words, once I'm a good connector, I continue to be a good connector, or get to be a better connector to the humans around me. So, for example, nice research out of Harvard Business School a few years ago showed that engineers in Silicon Valley who talked more at work were more productive. Wait, you're coming to my desk and chit-chatting about the movie you saw last week? What is that about? It's because they built these social ties, right? So now I know who I can call on when I get stuck on a project. I know who can help me. I know who to ask for advice. And so all that, small talk is actually useful from a neurologic perspective and from a downstream productivity perspective. So the famous example is when Steve Jobs was involved in the design of Pixar headquarters. And he had a single entrance, so one door, everyone goes in and out the same door. And he wanted one bathroom, which they didn't follow up on. Too many people, you can't have one bathroom. But he wanted people to have collisions. He thought, this is really important. Google does this. If you've been at, you probably have been at Google. I have a bunch of times. Yeah. That joint meal thing, yeah, it saves time. You don't have to get off campus and all that. But whenever I'm at Google, inevitably, and I'm giving a talk or something, people at lunch don't know each other. And I go, oh, you're working on the AI stuff. Oh, yeah, I heard about that. What about? And all of a sudden, they're talking. I don't even know what they're talking about. And these people who have worked at the same organization have this unscheduled, bump into each other. And all of a sudden, interesting things can happen. So conversation, good. This, I think, holds also in the virtual world, and maybe more importantly in the virtual world. Check in with your team. Make sure you take some time to talk about fun stuff. So in my company, Immersion Neuroscience, we started doing this virtual happy hour, which I had heard about. After a couple months of, being on quarantine, I thought, whatever. I'll do it for the kids. Honestly, it was so much fun. We all took our computers in the back of our houses or apartments. We had a couple beers. We laughed. We just goofed around. We had such a good time. So humans need that sense of connection. And even if you're a selfish bastard and you just want to make more money in your business, You got to connect and be nice to the people around you, right? So, and what happens is if you start doing that, it's like fake it till you make it. Even if it's not your nature to be super sociable. By the way, I'm an introvert, so I don't feel the need to socialize as much as say extroverts do. But once I start socializing, I really enjoy it, like everybody does. So it's not a waste of time. It's pleasurable. Oxytocin also reduces our stress responses. And so if I want to be less stressed out, more focused, more creative, and by the way, improves your immune system, maybe less likely to get infected by some pandemic virus that's rolling around the world, I need social interaction. Who knew?
Who knew? So Paul, there's a number of things you've mentioned there I want to unpack. You mentioned the virtual world. We've got leaders now and managers across organizations who are in charge of, forging a sense of direction. And the challenge, I think, right now is the emperor has no clothes on. In the past, we could say leaders knew where to take us. Leaders knew a sense of where we're going. But right now, nobody knows where to go. We're in such uncertainty about the sense of direction, where do we take the organizations? We don't even know if we're going to go back into lockdown again in the future, what's going to be happening. And so here we have employees reliant on leaders to, the clues in the title, direct, as directors. But we know they won't be able to, or certainly we know that they don't know any more than we do. How do leaders go about building a sense of trust in such an uncertain world? People don't know if they're going to have jobs, what's going to happen in the future with our economies, with trillions being spent on, propping up economies. What would leaders do, and what could they do in an uncertain world when they themselves are worried about their own future and that yet somehow I've got to keep my team motivated? What would you say in that? Any advice?
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with the premise. Okay. I think, I lead a couple different organizations and I'm always very clear about what I don't know. And I think what we've shown in our research, is that, that transparency and authenticity is a great way to have people follow you and get put in that discretionary effort. There's something about a crisis that really often will bring people together. Again, too much crisis and we're all going to separate. But if we know we're all in this together, and if I, as leaders, say, look, I need everyone's help. So in my startup, we had to put salary caps on. Like, you know, we had a bunch of canceled contracts. And he said, look, I think I can eventually get enough money to pay you what I owe you. But for now, I've got a cap salary so I can keep everybody employed. Nobody complained about that. You know, I mean, I don't think everyone was super happy, but people are working their butts off. And I said, you know what, this is the time. Let's make this thing happen. So again, not just my experience, but, you know, very good evidence that leaders who address what they don't know, who embrace their ignorance, are actually better leaders. So wrote a book on this a couple of years ago called Trust Factor, and have lots of examples of CEOs who, particularly in technical fields, who go, you know, I don't know how to do this thing, but you guys do. And I think we need to do this for our organization. Can you lead this effort? And then let me know what you've learned. And so that's okay, right? I mean, you know, we're as social creatures, and particularly with this social brain that we've evolved using oxytocin, we're really good at picking up people who are lying to us. Maybe not on the first conversation, but by the second or third, I can kind of get it, right? And so I'll do that. People are going to read their right. Just say, look, I think we really need to do this. I think what we're seeing now in the quarantine time is much more rapid pivots. And so experimentation is just going to be part of everyone's vocabulary from now on. I just saw that Siemens said that they're going to work anywhere forever. Like we do not expect that people, that's amazing. So there's Germans. Well, these are German people, right? It's amazing. Google probably said they're not going back at least until mid 2021 now. So as you said, we're in a different world. And I think that's where measurement is important, right? So if we are going on our gut, if we don't have the technology to tell us how effectively I'm connecting to my team, you know, whether I'm making an impact on individuals, then I'm hoping and praying that people things work out. And that's not a business plan. That's not an executable strategy. So I think, you know, better measurement and honestly coaching, you know, having people from the outside who can come in and say, you know, I have no dog in this fight, but here's what I'm seeing are potential weaknesses that you can address. In Trust Factor, I added some quotes from Michael Dell. Dell Computer, this is about 15 years ago, who couldn't keep his employees. I'm going to get to a point here, believe me. So all the senior leadership would turn over like every 6 to 12 months, just couldn't keep people. Anyway, finally, someone actually, you know, I don't know why, I'm losing all these people, he said, and finally someone had the nerve to tell him, it's you. You're a screamer. You push people too hard. People don't like working with you. And so he took that to heart and he got an executive coach and he's been very open about this. You can Google it. And kind of built in points, put a little plastic ear on his desk to remind him to listen more and talk less, right? All these things to help people become better, I say better leaders, but also better human beings. I think that's fair to say. I'm against the yelling leader. I don't think it's very effective. Very good evidence for that. So make a connection, be clear. If you've made a mistake, own it. You're the leader. You got to have ownership, right? I don't care if someone who works for you, you know, induced that mistake. You're the goddamn leader, right? You got to own this thing, right? If you're not owning it, you're not a leader. So I really think it's taking the time, done those connections, being clear, and those companies are more profitable and turnover is lower. So if you need an indication of whether your corporate culture, and that seems like this broad, vague word, but you know, we can clarify that. That's a set of behaviors between humans at work. Turnover is a good sign. High turnover for employees is a good sign that you're not doing a very good job, right? So I can keep you working here by putting you in the golden cage. I can pay you a ton of money and just assume that that's going to keep you here. But again, we've established that that's not a very good motivator. Or I can give you something important to do with a reliable team of people who are out to somehow improve the world, you know, at least a little bit. That's really motivating. So that's where trust comes in. And that's where the sense of purpose and having that be part of the conversations we have, part of the company's DNA.
You know, you talked about the sense of purpose. A lot of the time when I have, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in corporate life myself. And one of the things that used to irritate me were values and purpose as statements when you see them across organizations, and they're words that mean nothing. And, you know, that was almost one of the most irritating things, because actually sometimes or often they meant something to me. I would walk around the excited little boy, you know, wandering around thinking, oh God, I'm really into this. And you'd see the senior leaders just ticking the boxes, and we would bring it out every year for the year beginning meeting, whatever it might be, to say this is our purpose. But it would have no other purpose other than that, to say that we've got one. So, you know, I guess what you're saying is that we need to make sure that this is a living, breathing part of our organization that helps dictate how we are, what we do, and everything about us. I mean, whilst it sounds straightforward,
it doesn't always happen. Lived purpose. It's got to be part of that conversation. So I'll give you two quick examples. One is, I was at LinkedIn a couple of years ago, and every group I met with at LinkedIn, when those LinkedIn employees entered the room, they said, or I entered their room, whatever it was, they said, at LinkedIn, our purpose is to make our members more productive and more successful. Well, those are metrics that you can capture, at least the successful part you can. So they are required, apparently, to start that conversation. And then talking to more people, Jeff Weiner and others at LinkedIn, they said, that's a screen for us. If we're starting on some new project and it doesn't satisfy one of those two dimensions, we got to step back and go, why are we doing this? Right. So that's a lived purpose. The second example, which I love a lot, is the professional services company KPMG. Just like you said, they wanted to sort of accentuate purpose. This company's been around for a long time. And they went to their archives and they had these wonderful big black and white photos of all the times in history when KPMG was involved in momentous world events. So the Yalta conference at the end of World War II, KPMG analysts were there supporting the U.S. president. The Iran hostage crisis, KPMG. So these giant posters, and then you put them around the offices, and it was sort of interesting for a week. And then they realized, like, it's not lived. So they started this app called 10,000 Stories. So I said, you know, we found these really interesting stories in our archives and they're momentous, but I wonder if our consultants actually have these small stories about the mom and pop store or the, you know, small business that they solved a problem for that allowed them to maintain their employees and grow. And so they made this app and they just said, hey, when you got spare time, you know, put a little story in there about something that kind of gives you energy when you're at KPMG. And it was very aspirational, 10,000 stories. They said, yeah, maybe 4 or 5 years, we'll get 10,000 stories. They had 10,000 stories in 4 months. So last I looked, they had 30,000 stories. So this is really ground up. Like, this is actually what motivates me to come to work, right? I worked with this little company, or I worked with the CEO of this medium-sized tech business that was going under, and we helped them solve this problem. And so that's kind of a lived purpose. So again, for KPMG, you know, when you're looking at whatever, you got downtime, you're on the subway or something, and you open that app, you're like, oh, here's another person's story. So I think it's just lovely that they went from a top-down approach to that to a bottom-up approach.
And that you can imagine working in all those sort of organizations, onboarding, where you get to immerse yourself in those stories. If ever you want to understand where the organization you've joined, those sort of stories really bring to life that purpose that you then keep adding to. So Paul, you know, in this virtual world, you said, you know, there's organizations now that are saying they're never going to come back. Offices are redundant. We're going to work from wherever anybody wants to work from. I hear that a lot. People are saying, look, I just want you to be productive. You know, I think it was the 80s or 90s, we had the results only work environment. You know, you remember Best Buy?
I do. Yeah. Roar.
Yeah. So, And here we are, you know, and I myself with our team, you know, I'm only focused on let's get the output. So I don't mind where you work from. And we've always had that. The challenge comes, I guess, again, from my own background and my own experience, is that leaders and managers are the highest correlating factors to employee engagement. And a lot of the time, those collisions you described, you know, when you get to bump into people and at work, when those environments aren't there, but now we're reliant on screens to engage with each other. How would an introverted leader, and many are, I've come across many leaders who aren't comfortable being out there. They did the quarterly roadshow or the town hall meeting because they had to, and they were shoved out and sort of did their little bit and ran back. How would leaders and managers now go about being visible, creating environments of trust when we're relegated to the screens? What would you say to people who aren't comfortable in this environment? This isn't natural for them. And faking it till you make it feels inauthentic. and they're worried that people are seeing through that, and it's almost adding to the mistrust. What would you say?
I think it's an investment of time. I think, you know, just like with a romantic partner or children, there's an investment of time. So there's this old saying to listen with your eyes. So if I'm looking at you, even if I'm looking at you virtually, I'm present, right? And you know, get rid of the damn phone and, you know, focus, right? So that could be small group meetings. A friend of mine named Jerry Stead, who's run a bunch of Fortune 100 tech companies, is a very healthy guy. And he used to have this thing called Juice with Jerry. And so, yeah, so Jerry would you know, kind of randomly, this is, you know, where we could meet in person, but, you know, randomly pull, 20 employees, and they go get juice and sit in the cafe and just hang out. And that let him see what's happening on the front line. So it's all, you know, no holds barred, do whatever you want to do. You know, bitch and moan at me if you're unhappy about something, or tell me what you like, or tell me what we should be improving. So I really think it's important for leaders of organizations of any size to be on the ground with either customer facing or with employees who are customer facing. And that's increasingly hard in the virtual world. But the virtual world's, you know, we're going to solve this problem. Either everyone gets COVID or we get a vaccine or something. So, you know, we're going to go back to having meetings, probably not as many as we used to. And for me, I live in California. So I used to fly to New York for a 2-hour meeting, you know, fly 6 hours across country. I think that's going to go away, right? So, and maybe that should go away. So I think you're exactly right. We've got to be better at connecting. So here's some things that we found work based on the research in my lab and others, which is take the first couple of minutes just for that chit chat. Let's get to know. Hi, I'm Rhett. How are you? How's your day going? Are you holding? How's your family? Are you doing all right? That's okay. Again, this is an investment in connection, right? And then great. And then have some, like I mentioned this guy, Jerry, you know, have some downtime where we're going to have kind of hangout time, virtual happy hour. We're just going to enjoy being together, not obligated to do it. And then if you're leading a bigger organization, do small groups. Have people randomly put their names in and say, hey, we're going to have a cocktail hour and we're going to talk about, I'm holding up something. Why? I have a flashlight in my hand. Why flashlights are so important to our business. And so if you care about flashlights, the first 20 people that sign up, I'll cover your bar tab or whatever that is. So, you know, think about the human side of work, right? The robots haven't taken over yet. We still have humans who are executing this. So really empower them. And some of the great business leaders that really are kind of heroes of mine were great on the front lines. And even if we're introverts, thinking of Herb Kelleher, who started Southwest Airlines, right? Out there handing out drinks on the planes, you know, moving luggage with the guys. Let me tell you how much you learn if you're on those front lines with employees and with customers. I sit down and chat with people. What do you like about Southwest? What do you hate? What's the worst thing about this experience? People will tell you. Number one. Number two, you know, we have technology. So I'm going to make a little mini plug for my startup, Immersion Neuroscience. Companies are using this worldwide now to actually assess neurologically how effective meetings are. Am I making a connection or not? Right? Is the meeting too long? So one of our clients, have been very public about this, Accenture, has used our technology to assess training and meetings that they hold in person, but now virtually. And they found that the virtual world, you can't really sustain immersion. I can't get you to really care about immersion. It's a kind of deep emotional state where I really care about what's happening virtually as well as I can in person. We sort of knew that. So in person, they had what I call the 20-20-20 rule. No one presents for more than 20 minutes, and then some participatory task. Let's figure out how to use this information, and then 20-minute debrief. Online, they're talking much more about no one talks for more than 10 or 12 minutes before we all do something, before we engage, before we have a discussion. So connection is metabolically costly to the brain. I've got to put energy into it, which means I'm taking energy away from other things that your brain could be doing. So shorter, more intensive, participatory, give people time to do those tasks. Empower young people to run a meeting. It's a great way to build trust, right? So if I'm the leader, why am I running this meeting? I say, hey, Bob, you've been here a year. I think you're ready to meeting. Set an agenda. Maybe I'll review it before you, and you run the meeting. I'll sit in the back. So one thing that inhibits oxytocin, really, sorry, very long answer. I've been doing this a long time.
No, I've got too much information in my head. You carry on. I could listen to you all day, I promise.
Bless you. One thing that inhibits oxytocin release is threat or challenge. And one way to reduce that at work, because inevitably we sort of have hierarchies, even if you have a relatively flat organizational structure, is what I call dominance displays. So if I walk into the office, when we did that, in a $10,000 suit, and everyone else is wearing polo shirts, we're showing off.
Yeah.
And what's the natural, internal, maybe people want to is, guy's kind of an ass, yeah, right? So look, if we're wearing polo shirts, and I see a lot of Zoom is, our video conferencing, is everyone's just wearing, we're home, so we're wearing casual clothes. And I don't have to wear a tie. It's weird. I had one video conference recently with a guy in a tie, and I'm like, dude, you're at home. What? He goes, no, I like wearing a tie. I'm like, oh, you're messed up. That's bad. Paul, just put
Paul,
a shirt on.
I have to say, Paul, when I started working from home way, way back many, many years ago, psychologically, I had to get into my shirt and tie to
Did
work from
really?
Home. And I used to take the tie off to then indicate that I've stopped working. And I'm a freak of
That's
nature.
That's not so bad.
I can relate to that.
So whatever works for you. But I think, again, it's having that sense of real connection and understanding that these human beings are complicated. So reduce dominance displays, be a team member. If you're a leader, whatever the worst part of the job that your colleagues have to do, make sure you do it first. Be on the front lines, right? So in my academic lab, we do a lot of work with blood. So we draw blood from participants in experiments to see what their brain's doing. And I always make sure I'm in that blood room. I'm processing blood. It's actually, I kind of like it, but it's seen that, it's a biohazard. You got to be careful. And yeah, I'm going to take a shift for sure. And I'm going to take the first shift if I can. Right. So I want to make sure that I'm there. People see me doing this, whatever they clean the toilets, whatever they, yeah, go clean some toilets once in a while. If you run a retail business, it's all right. Yeah. And guess what? You figure out if they're being cleaned well, people will see you out there. So, say hi to clients. So anyway, I reduce those dominance displays that shows that we're all part of the same team. We're all pulling together. We're all doing the same thing. You got to take the hit once in a while, right? So,
Yeah, and thankfully, those dominant displays are certainly, I think, relegated to the 80s and 90s. Hopefully, that's far more or far less frequent, thankfully. Paul, I am fascinated with your research, and I've been reading it for many, many years. So it really is a privilege for me to talk to you today. And but one of the things I'm really interested in is your work in oxytocin fascinated me, and you're on a different scale. What is the work that you've come across recently that fascinates you? What is it, the research that you've come across that you think, wow, that's really, really interesting? Is there any out there?
There are. I'm in so many different areas. So we have been doing a lot of research on psychiatric disorders. So really developing bioassays to understand how to identify why people are suffering. And I think, can't talk fully about that, but also criminal behaviors, I think is very interesting. I think in the current world, I think very interesting work is on the role of loneliness. So I think there's some really excellent research showing that loneliness has extreme detrimental effects on individuals. And so certainly, depressive symptoms, increased risk of suicide, impaired immune system. And so when we can't see people, when we can't give you that touch on the shoulder or a hug or a greeting, I think it's really incumbent on us to think about those people who are more isolated, who maybe live alone or, don't have people who love them close by, and make those connections. So I think, if there's any takeaway from this, connection is absolutely essential for humans, for productivity, but also for health and happiness. And so make an effort, whether you're a leader or not, to make that connection, check in on people. And can it be easy as saying, hey, Henry, how are you? Are you doing okay? Yeah. Or again, read the eyes, right? That give you so much information on emotion. Hey, you look tired today. Are you all right? Yeah. What's going on? Yeah. And you have to be authentic, right? So, really care about those humans around you. But look, if those are people that you work with, honestly, if you're a leader, they care about you. They wouldn't work for you unless they're in the golden cage. They're not going to work for you unless they actually care about you and what you're doing. And so you have this, I think, sacred privilege to lead a group of individuals to do something hopefully important in the world. And the reciprocal responsibility from that privilege is to care for those people and care for them emotionally, but also physically and through salary. So yeah, put a little effort in. Loneliness is a killer, sadly. So I think we're at higher risk for that.
Yeah, we did a podcast on that a while back on loneliness, and it's interesting when you start to read it how prevalent it's becoming in the way that we live. So, and your point about connection, employee engagement. One of my frustrations is engagement. Well, it's not people join organizations engaged. Disengagement is what we do to them, but they join. The default is they're happy. They wanted to come and work and do their best, and it's allowing them to excel and creating that space where people thrive, where we get the best out of each other. So great, thank you. Paul, I just want to say thank you so much for your time today. As I said, I'm a huge fan. I had to try and control my excitement about talking to you today. Your research is fascinating, and I will continue to follow everything you do. It's been great. So thank you very much for being my guest today.
It was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. So a huge thank you to Paul for joining me as a guest on our podcast. I am so happy and delighted, and there's so much to be gained from understanding oxytocin and what goes on inside us when we connect and join together and bond, and some of these collisions that we have at work, how do we recreate them in the environments we're in now? Fascinating. Thank you, Paul. Really loved talking to you. That's all from us today. Please join us again for future guests and podcasts talking about leadership development, employee engagement, and everything else in between. Amrit Sander from The Engagement Coach. I will see you soon. Take care.
The Engagement Coach Podcast.